Good morning and welcome to our Alaska Collaborative on Health and the Environment teleconference on NIEHS and Environmental Health Disparities in Alaska with Dr. Linda Birnbaum, Director of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences and the National Toxicology Program of the National Institutes of Health. My name is Diana DeFazio, and on behalf of Alaska Community Action on Toxics, I'll be facilitating today's call. This call is sponsored by the Alaska Collaborative on Health and the Environment, or CHE Alaska. CHE Alaska is a regional partnership group of the National Collaborative on Health and the Environment, and CHE Alaska aims to advance knowledge and effective action to address growing concerns about the links between human health and environmental factors. You can find more information online at akaction.org and at healthandenvironment.org. Our call will last 1 hour, and we'll have time at the end for your questions. Again, Dr. Birnbaum will be referencing slides during her presentation, and everyone who signed up should have received a link to a PDF of the presentation slides. If you still need to download them, they can be found by clicking on the title of today's call on our homepage at akaction.org. And now I'd like to invite Vi Wyhee, Environmental Health and Justice Program Director for Alaska Community Action on Toxics, to welcome and introduce Dr. Birnbaum.
Good afternoon, Dr. Birnbaum. My name is Vi Wyhee, and good morning to our Alaska callers. My name is Vi. I'm the daughter of the late John and Della Wyhee. I'm Native Village Sivunga Tribal member, and I'm Environmental Health and Justice Program Director here at Alaska Community Action on Toxics. I'd like to introduce Dr. Linda Birnbaum. She's Director of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences of the National Institutes of Health and the National Toxicology Program. As NIEHS and NTP Director, Birnbaum oversees funds of biomedical research to discover how the environment influences our human health and disease. The Institute also supports training, education, technology, transfer, and community outreach. NIEHS currently funds more than 1,000 research grants. Dr. Birnbaum has received many awards and recognitions. She is also author of more than 600 peer-reviewed publications, book chapters, and reports. Birnbaum's own research focuses on the pharmacokinetic behavior of environmental chemicals, mechanisms of action of toxicants, including endocrine disruption, and linking of real-world exposures to health effects. A native of New Jersey, Birnbaum received her MS and her PhD in microbiology from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. I have been a member of NIEHS's National Advisory Environmental Health Science Council. I got nominated several years ago to give a community perspective, and I am originally from St. Lawrence Island, where we have two formerly used defense sites, and we're some of the most highly contaminated population on the planet because of our reliance on our customary traditional foods. And our community-based project has been funded by NIEHS since 2000, basically because the burden of proof has been put on us. And our research has shown that our families closely associated with Northeast Cape, one of the two FUD sites on our island, we have 10 times more PCB levels in the blood of our people, which has greatly affected the health and well-being of our community members. We basically have health disparities. We have cancer crisis right now, and our children have two times more birth defects than the lower 48. Our Alaska Native children have two times more birth defects than non-natives in the state of Alaska. These are health disparities caused by the population of the planet. Even though we don't have manufacturers or chemical plants on our island, we are being disproportionately affected by these global contaminants. and from our families closely associated with Northeast Cape have even more higher cancer rates. Last year, as part of council, Dr. Birnbaum, during each council, she gives a report. And last May, I believe, the council meets three times a year, and I travel from Anchorage to North Carolina. And in her report, she stated that she had gone to Indian country to do a community forum, and that she went to the Navajo Nation who had been affected by uranium mining. I saw this as a great opportunity to invite Dr. Birnbaum to St. Lawrence Island, and we found out earlier this year that she was coming. So we brought her to St. Lawrence Island January of this year, and she is here to talk about what she has learned and also her experience and how to talk about the health disparities that we're seeing in Alaska. Dr. Birnbaum?
Thank you very, very much, Vi, and I hope everyone can hear me clearly. If someone has a question, you know, I don't mind being interrupted, or you can save it to the end. But good morning. I'm really, because I know it's still morning in Alaska, I just kind of, you've been told who I am, so I don't have to give much of an introduction other than to tell you is that I actually started at NIEHS as a postdoc and spent 10 years here and then moved across the lake here in North Carolina to EPA's health research lab, where I directed the largest health research program at EPA and spent 19 years there. And then I returned to NIEHS on January 20th, 2009, to become the director of NIEHS, which has been quite a fabulous ride. So just if you go to slide 2, which says the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, this is telling you who we are, that we are one of 27 institutes and centers of the NIH, and we are the only one not located in Bethesda Park, or headquartered, I should say, in Bethesda, Maryland. We're located in Research Triangle Park, which we have often called the southern part of heaven. We are the premier environmental health sciences research institution in the world, with both vibrant intramural laboratories and, as Vi mentioned, extramural funding to our over 1,000 grantees. Like most of our sister NIH institutes, most of our funding goes to support our extramural research and training activities in universities and research institutions and community groups across the nation. In addition, we provide the headquarters and leadership and most of the funding for the cross-agency National Toxicology Program, which is headquartered here at NIEHS, but it also involves parts of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and parts of the Food and Drug Administration. So we're kind of unique at NIH, not only because we're not in Bethesda, but because we're the only ones whose research has a primary focus on preventing disease rather than diagnosing and treating it. We do conduct clinical research as well, but we are different, again, from the rest of NIH in our understanding and commitment to prevention and public health. So this means that we have a commitment to conducting outreach, engagement, education, training, and supporting community partnerships, in addition to the highest quality, most rigorous laboratory or clinically based science. We do believe that in order to fulfill our mission of reducing the burden of human illness and disability associated with environmental exposures, research must lead to public health action. And this means that we have an obligation not only to produce the best science possible, but also to disseminate that science and bring it to bear on policy decisions and public health protection. So the next slide is, so why does environmental health matters? It matters because millions of lives can be improved by simply better understanding how the environment affects our health. For example, 13 million deaths could be prevented per year by improving our environment. That environmental factors influence 85 of the 102 non-communicable diseases recognized by WHO. that environmental factors account at least in part for two-thirds of all cancer cases in the United States. And then I think the most important thing is an easy-to-remember tagline, which is you can't change your genes, but you can change your environment. If we go to the next slide, which has a beautiful picture of my youngest granddaughter on it, I think it's important to realize that environmental health is a very broad topic. So I think often people think about chemicals and substances found in pollution, but the environment also includes the food we eat, the drugs we take, and social and economic factors leading to stress. Gotta have a drink, sorry. I think one thing that's important to note is that these factors don't act in isolation, but they can interact with each other, and all of these can lead to adverse health outcomes. If we go to the next slide, number 5, I think it's important to understand that not all environmental exposures are the same. Exposure science is very complicated. There are thousands of chemicals in our environment, things like endocrine disruptors and complex mixtures. We have different ways in which we can be exposed. We can inhale things. We can get things through our water, drink things, or we can get it through our skin by washing contaminated water. We certainly are exposed to many contaminants through our food. And we're beginning to understand that what we eat, our diet, has dramatic impacts on how we respond to other stressors. We can be exposed to pathogens. And again, the interaction between chemical exposure and pathogens is just now beginning to be elucidated. We know that depending on who is the recipient of the exposure, things can differ because of your genetic susceptibility, because of your past history. Depending when it occurs during your lifetime, is this during development, is this during puberty, is this when you're a healthy young adult, the can lead to a very different not only exposure but response, and clearly how large the dose may be can influence the response. So we're beginning to understand that diseases and dysfunction are not actually the same thing. There are many, many, many different kinds of diseases that have different mechanisms that can occur over a long period of time. If we go to the next slide, slide with all the arrows here, is stressing the fact that early life exposures can have lifetime impacts. It is even beginning to be plausible that all non-infectious diseases may originate during development. So the developmental period is particularly vulnerable to environmental chemicals because tissues and organs are forming at different rates, and our immune system is immature during development. DNA repair is not fully functional in all our cell types during in utero development. The metabolism, the liver is one of its major roles, is to metabolize chemicals, and that metabolic capability is usually not developed fully, for some enzymes by birth, for some not until 2 years of age. The blood-brain barrier, for example, or other organ barriers like the intestinal barriers are not fully formed during early development. And we're beginning to understand the mechanism by which these changes occur, which is altered gene expression brought about by what we call epigenetics, which involves no change in the primary sequence of DNA, but alters when genes are turned on or off. In this slide, I think one thing that's important, and I could have put lots more arrows on this, is that not only are there windows of susceptibility, for example, during gestation, but there are also susceptible times in our lives anytime our body is rapidly changing. So during childhood or during puberty or, for example, during pregnancy for a woman. The next slide, again, stresses the fact that early life exposure can have lasting effects, and there's a whole new field called The Developmental Basis of Human Adult Disease, which is often abbreviated as DOHAD. I think some things that, you know, I mentioned the epigenetics, which is the changes in gene expression. And we know that this occurs especially during development. This is really the basis of why a skin cell is not a lung cell, is not a hair cell. But what happens during development is usually not reversible. So when we think about, say, hormone action, our hormone systems maintain our basic homeostasis as adults. But during development, our hormones actually have an organizational role in the formation of not only our tissues and our organs, but of how things work together. And if we perturb them during development, we're not going to be able to reverse those effects. I think another important thing about this whole early life exposure and long-term effects is that sometimes there can be a long latency before the effect can even be seen. So, for example, we know that you may alter, for example, the capability, say, of the testes to produce sperm. You wouldn't know that when the child is born. You wouldn't know, might not know that, in fact, until the child becomes a man and has trouble becoming a father. So, again, there's this issue of latency from early life exposures. We go to the next slide, which is number, I don't see a number on this one. Well, it's the one that says important questions to ask of environmental chemicals. I think untested chemical substances are rapidly proliferating. Many of the new chemicals have not been tested properly, and some have not been tested at all. So, for example, the structure that you have up in the right-hand corner of that slide is looking at BPS, which is chemically structurally related to BPA, bisphenol A, which was removed from baby bottles and supposed to be removed from hard sippy cups and so on, but is still present in the linings of cans. And we're finding BPS in people and in the environment, and we know next to nothing about it. Some of the chemicals of concern are persistent, which means that they bioaccumulate in the environment and will be with us for a very long time, which can cause long-term consequences to our environment and our health. We're beginning to understand, again, that chemicals like phthalates and PAHs, or polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or some of the flame retardants, that exposure can lead to long-term health effects from these compounds. We need to replace some of these chemicals that we know are problematic, but we need not to replace them with something that, in fact, may be worse. On the next slide, which talks about new strategies for environmental health sciences, the picture is actually the cover of our new strategic plan, which is readily accessible from our website. The plan was developed by a very inclusive process involving not only NIEHS scientists, but many, many different stakeholders in a multi-step process. And I think some of the things that are recognized in this is that environmental health science is changing very rapidly. We used to think that higher doses are invariably worse than lower doses, but we now know that some low-dose effects can occur and can have a substantial impact on our health. While in many places of the world, some of the most important problems are excessive exposures to highly toxic heavy metals or pesticides or things like PCBs, new understanding of how low-level common exposures contribute to the development of common disorders such as diabetes, developmental problems, and other modern epidemics is changing the traditional paradigm. It's not enough to simply acknowledge the environment has effect on people's health. We need to recognize that our old assumptions about toxicants and how they affect our bodies are being changed. We used to quote a 15th century scientist called Paracelsus saying the dose makes poison, but we now know that timing is critical for the effects that result. And we've also come to learn that toxic effects on the epigenome, so that's the turning on and off genes, can result in disease not just for the person exposed, but for their grandchildren. So now I kind of want to turn to Alaska on the next slide. And this is a picture of the beautiful beach adjacent to Savunga. Vi mentioned that I visited Alaska the end of July, and in some ways it was a life-changing experience. It took us 2 days to get to Savunga because the weather was bad, and they just fly very small planes from Nome, planes that are also delivering supplies to the island. Savunga is one of two relatively small native communities on St. Lawrence Island. The community was extremely excited the day that we were there, not so much I think about us, but I think about the fact that the Russians were coming. And by the Russians, I mean the Siberian Yupik, who are their relatives, and they had not had a visit in many, many years with family members, with friends, and so on. And two boatloads of Siberian Yupiks did arrive at Gamble on the north end of the island the day they were there. We did not get to meet them because they had not yet made it to Savunga. But when I visited Alaska, in addition to visiting Savunga and Nome and Chicxulub and Anchorage, I think I spoke at least 8 times. I participated in lots of community meetings with elders, with a women's talking circle, with community leaders, and also with scientists, and with the medical establishment, both in Nome and in Anchorage. So if we go to the next slide, this is a picture that occurred on Savunga when I met with the elders. And as Vi has mentioned, the people on St. Lawrence Island are dealing with a triple threat. First, the abandoned military base. And while the abandoned military base, Savunga is not on top of the abandoned military base at their end of the island, it is where their summer whaling camp was. But I believe that Gamble actually sits almost on top of the abandoned military base. Oh, I guess you're Alaskan, so you know how close St. Lawrence is to the international dateline, and that actually on a clear day, you really could see Siberia from St. Lawrence Island. Vi also mentioned the fact that that our northern peoples in many ways are the most contaminated people on our planet, and this is both because of the issue of global distillation, where industrial chemicals and other agents basically go up into the air at temperate zones, and then they come out and settle down into the Arctic. And in addition, when you're dealing with subsistence hunters and fishers, the wildlife at the top of the food chain is going to be heavily contaminated. And the St. Lawrence Island Yupik, their main diet, traditional diet, is bowhead whale and seal and walrus. And I have to mention that there was an article in the paper today about the walruses beaching in northern Alaska because they can't, the sea ice is too far away now. Okay, on the next slide, it says Women's Talking Circle, and this is when I met with, this is just a picture of me meeting with the women who have some concerns that are different from the men. Plus, it's always helpful, especially I think in certain communities, for women to feel free to express their own concerns. And I think that was important. On the next slide is another picture of the village of Savunga. And those pipes are carrying both drinking water and sewage, obviously separated. There is a sewage treatment facility on the island, which is good. But because you're on the permafrost, obviously this has to all be above ground. So some of the exposures that the people on St. Lawrence are very concerned with, and again, I should say this is not unique to St. Lawrence Island. The military contamination may be specific to them, although we have military contamination in many areas of Alaska. But the Yupik are concerned about mercury, arsenic, PCBs, among other compounds. If we go to the next slide, is the picture near Chickaloon Tribal Center. The woman on the left in kind of the turquoise shirt is their major health provider or health person. And we're standing by the stream, which is one of their major fishing streams, and they are extremely concerned right on the edge of their area. A mining permit has been granted, and they were not, you know, they can't actually mitigate that happening unless they want to give up their tribal rights, which obviously they don't want to do. And there's certainly lots of precedents for mining to lead to stream contamination and loss, not only of fish in the stream, but of other parts of the traditional hunting ground. So that's a great concern there. I also met with elders in Chickaloon. This community is extremely concerned about increasing rates of pancreatic and bladder cancer. They're concerned about the ponds near where the mines go in, which are very often colored and very foul smelling. And they're also concerned about the underground fires that can occur with mining, and some of those can last for years. So on the next page, we were looking at right near where we could see where the proposed strip mine would be. And I think one of the things that I did, and I didn't mention that when after I visited St. Lawrence, I visited the known tribal health centers and those directors. And finally, I was able to get a commitment from them. And Vi, I hope you'll fill in. That they would, in fact, send a team of healthcare workers to St. Lawrence, because at this point, there is a health aide, and that is the extent of the medical care available on the island. And there has never really been a survey of the health of the Yupik on St. Lawrence Island. I did have very interesting discussions as well with meeting the the Native American Tribal Health Center representatives and the South Central Tribal Health Center representatives in Alaska, but let me get back to that. Anyhow, so we're very pleased with what we'll be able to achieve on St. Lawrence Island. In Chickaloon, they are obviously nearer to, for example, Anchorage, but there are real issues of health, the accessibility of health care there. This was just a beautiful picture that I had to put in that we saw while we were driving near Chickaloon. But when I met with the Native Tribal Health Consortium and South Central Foundation, and that was at the request of Senator Lisa Murkowski, we talked about sharpening the focus on environmental health, not to lessen the concerns for smoking or tobacco, but to talk about air pollution, to talk about getting communities involved in their health advocacy and other environmental exposures that can affect health. In addition to the tribal visits and meeting with the health experts, I did visit some of our grantees at the University of Alaska in Anchorage, who are looking at air pollution, early childhood health, pesticides, heavy metals, and the whole issue of gene-environment interaction. They're also working with ACAT related to the environmental assessments of impacted populations on St. Lawrence Island and other communities. If you go to the next slide, which is global environmental health, this is just giving you kind of our information that we are now the only NIH to have a collaborating center with the World Health Organization. And that provides us an organizational framework and venue for many of the global environmental activities that we are involved in, as well as linking us to important partners. So the focus of this center at this time is children's environmental health, climate change, the developmental origins of health and disease, the issue of electronic waste or e-waste, and then the real issue of indoor air pollution and cook stoves. We know that about 4 million people die every year from indoor air pollution associated with cook stoves, and the great majority of those are children. If we go to the next slide, guys, these are just some pictures that that we pulled off looking at the whole issue of climate change. So we know now that there's no question that glacial retreat is being observed in North America and throughout the world. Many glaciers have completely disappeared in recent decades. For example, in Glacier National Park in Montana, in 1850, there were about 150 glaciers, and then about the same number in 1910 when the park was established. By 4 years ago, there were only 25 glaciers left, and the prediction is that there will be none by 2025. Now, glacial retreat can lead to changes in our local ecosystems and water supply. Glaciers act as water reserves in the form of snow and ice, and they supply meltwater during the summer and can have tremendous negative impacts if that water is no longer available. We're also finding worldwide that ambient water temperatures, both in large lakes like the Great Lakes and in the oceans, are rising, and this affects both plants and animals and where they can survive. The U.S. Geological USGS predicts that glacial retreat will result in more forest fires and, for example, more mountain pine beetle infestations that right now are decimating the pine forests, for example, in the Rockies. So NIEHS has been interested in the health impacts of climate change actually starting in about 2000. But in 2009, we formed a cross-federal agency work group to identify what are some of the key research needs in what areas, produced a white paper that was published in our journal, Environmental Health Perspectives, that focused on some of the health effects that are linked to climate change, and not only focusing on the impacts, but also how we can mitigate some of these impacts by reducing greenhouse gases or adapting to climate change better. So I think those were the main things I wanted to stress, and I am more than happy to answer questions. Hello?
Thank you, Dr. Birnbaum. It's wonderful that we have this time for discussion during the call. And so right now I'd like to open the lines for your questions. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star 2 to unmute your line. When you're finished, please press star 2 to mute it again so we don't end up with a lot of background noise. And please state your name and affiliation. Try to be brief just to make sure we get to several people before the end of the hour.
Hello. This is Pat Hilgard, and I'm calling from Washington, D.C. I noticed.
Oh, Alaska. Thank you, Pat, for telling me.
Hi. And I noticed that there was nothing in this presentation about the oil and gas industry or about oil spills or oil spill cleanups and the use of dispersants, the health effects still going on from 1990, and the plan for the regional government to continue new cleanup strategies with dispersants. And I'd appreciate it if Linda could discuss that.
Well, thank you, Pat. That's a very good question. I didn't talk about the issue of oil spills because in Alaska, I didn't talk about the issue of oil spills because we're not funding any oil spill or have not been involved in that currently in Alaska. We are funding a close to $70 million effort related to the Gulf oil spill that occurred in 2010. And this is at least a 10-year longitudinal study that we're doing, as well as we have consortium grantees with several of the other NIH institutes and centers based in four Gulf universities and over 25 different community groups that are focusing, again, on the impacts of the Gulf oil spill. But part of this is, yes, we are seeing health impacts. Yes, 2 years and 3 years out, we are seeing impacts on psychosocial issues and stress. And we're also seeing some pulmonary effects. But I think that we are hopeful that by the studies we do there, they will help inform how we respond to other oil spills. I think most of us do know that the Valdez oil spill, the community and the ecosystem has not recovered to what it was before that oil spill. I hope those are, as far as the use of the heavy use of dispersants, we are looking at that in our study of over 32,000 cleanup workers who were involved in the spill.
Will you have any input into decisions for the future with cleanup procedures? There are other mechanisms which can be used other than dispersants, and they have been kept off the table of the toolbox to be used.
Yeah. So the answer is we do work very closely with our other federal partners. I think a lot will happen, will determine what happens with the results of our studies and others that are ongoing to see whether we see some adversities that are appear to be associated with the dispersants. We're not looking at the ecological impacts, but there are people who are doing that as well. We have recently, last year, Dr. Collins at the end of the year gave us $500,000 to develop a research rapid response protocol. We've worked with the National Library of Medicine and the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response in Health and Human Services, and are in the process of developing what I would say kind of pre-cleared human studies protocol and a drop-down menu. Those are available on the National Library of Medicine website, so that part of our objective is that we want the research that we conduct to inform how you would respond in future and improve our response and improve the health, because we know there will be future disasters.
Thank you, Vi Wally. If I can just comment, what this Dr. Birnbaum's trip to St. Lawrence Island has meant for our community. As I mentioned, you know, we have health disparities, and you know, for a long time, our communities, tribal leaders, elders, and myself, we have been trying to bring awareness, like Annie Aloha did for 20 years, about all the cancers in our people. Dr. Birnbaum is a well-established toxicologist, and my comment is that Western science and researchers are finally accepting our local and elder knowledge when it comes to our environment. But when it comes to us talking about the health disparities and what we're seeing in our communities, that is not taken into account. So what this has meant for us is that her talks, whether it was in the boardrooms with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, with South Central Foundation, or with Norton Sound Health Corporation in Nome, it has validated our health disparities. Because, like I mentioned, we've been trying to bring awareness because nobody has been helping us with our health. And I felt really good with her coming. We're seeing the fruits of her trip. Her trip with us to Nome has empowered our tribal leaders with Norton Sound Health Corporation Board. We're seeing opportunities come up to help us address the health disparities. And it has validated our data, which is sound data, and the research that we've done on St. Lawrence Island. So I just wanted to share that with this group.
Thank you, Vi. Are there other questions? I saw a few people look like they had unmuted the line to ask a question. We'd especially like to invite questions from Alaska, since much of the presentation did focus on Dr. Birnbaum's trip to Alaska.
This is Kendra up in Chickalone. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hey, Kendra.
Hi, Dr. Birnbaum. Yeah, this is Kendra Zamzo. I had two questions. The first is basically, how can we best approach food choices? And that's for both Arctic communities and more road-based communities like Chickalone. Because you've talked about some marine mammals have contaminants and they're a food source in the Arctic. We also know there's chemicals in store-bought food that interact with stressors to cause disease. And we know there's things like red meat that increase the risk to cancer. So, you know, how do we then approach the best food choices individually and for our families?
Yeah, that's a really, really hard question. You know, I think, you know, we don't want people going away from their traditional diet and starting to eat McDonald's and fried foods and so on all the time. So I think we have to be practical about what we can do. I think, for example, I know there have been successes or relative successes with some of our tribal communities in the lower 48. For example, if the fish that they ate were highly contaminated with PCBs, a lot of the PCBs are in the fat and in the skin. So if they ate fillets instead of the entire fish, and if instead of eating the biggest fish, which would have the most PCBs because they've lived the longest, they ate smaller fish, that was, you know, one thing where they could still eat their traditional food, but, you know, be less exposed. We know, for example, that, you know, different contaminants may be in different parts of the animals. We also, like by some of the sampling that they're doing up on St. Lawrence Island, they're beginning to understand, you know, where the contaminants are in their food chain and try to avoid it. Now, that's very problematic. Like for the Yupik, for example, blubber and skin is very important to their health and their culture, and blubber and skin are highly contaminated. So, but there are ways that if you eat less, that's good. I think one of the things that we have to, at least as far as like some of the things like PCBs and dioxins and some of the organochlorine pesticides, the good news is since those have been banned, the levels are starting to go down, both in wildlife and in people in general. Now, there can be obviously exceptions, and that's the good news. So there's no easy answer. I mean, I think it's the old stories. You've got to kind of say what makes sense to eat. You know, we're still, you know, the more green and leafy vegetables people can eat, you know, the less fatty foods as far as fatty animal products people can eat, probably better for their health. I don't know if that's what you wanted to hear, Kendra.
Yeah, that helps a little bit. I had a second question, too, more related to what's happening in Chickalone, on health impact assessments. I wondered if you're familiar with those.
These are the ones that ATSCR does, or these are the ones that NIOSH does, or neither?
Well, I think neither. It's through the state of Alaska, but it might be closer to ATSCR.
Okay. So they're doing an assessment of the potential impact of the mine?
They're beginning to do it for all large-scale projects, I believe, whether it's mining or another large-scale project.
Well, that's encouraging. If they use the issue is that are they going to use a public health model or are they going to use a medical model?
Oh, that's interesting.
You know, because the point is with environmental exposures, it's often difficult it's hard to find a smoking gun and prove that someone's health effects are due to the exposures that they're experiencing. But you can see but it's easier to see that if you have in a population basis where you might see all of a sudden that there's an increase in a certain health condition.
And I think that can be difficult with some of these communities because they're so small that they say there is no statistical.
Absolutely. So my suggestions would be look at other communities where this kind of major operation has been launched and what has happened in those communities.
Okay. And I was also wondering, yeah, so I hope you maybe take a look at some of the HIAs that are being developed. Alaska apparently is being kind of in the lead nationally on how to do this.
Send me one or two.
Sure, I'll do that. Yeah, and I'm a little bit worried about how you get a handle on the non-physical aspects like stress and spiritual impacts of
that's why
impacting the land.
Obviously, the non-physical, like, you know, stress, more behavioral issues are harder to measure, but they can be. And again, I think in some ways, doing it by analogy to another location where you have some data could be very helpful. Because in a very small population like you have in Chickalone, it's going to be really hard to prove a direct association.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you. We have time for one or two more questions.
Hello, Diana. This is Pam.
Yes. Hi, Pam.
Hello, everyone. And Dr. Birnbaum, I just want to thank you again. We were so honored to have this opportunity to journey with you in Alaska in July for 5 days for a very intensive series of visits, as you've described. And I think my lasting impression was just your deep understanding and compassion as you listened to elders and the women and the community leaders talk about the health issues and the real health disparities that people are facing in Savunga, on St. Lawrence Island, and Chickalune. And you've described this as a life-changing experience. So my question is, I was just interested to hear you reflect a little bit more on what that means for you and any particularly memorable impressions that you have and what you'll remember most about your journey to Alaska, what you heard and learned while you were here. And thank you again so much.
Oh, well, and by the way, Pam, I missed seeing you when I saw Vi and Sama for the Partnerships and Environmental Health meeting, but you weren't here and I was disappointed. So you should. Anyway, I think the reality of the problem hit me really hard. It's one thing to read about it. It's another thing to actually see it. You know, there's nothing like actually meeting and talking to the people who are having to deal with this on a daily basis. You know, I did have some of that when I visited the Navajo. I heard some of that when I visited the Flathead Reservation in northern Montana. But I think it was absolutely starkest in Alaska. So I think that's one thing. I think another real take-home message to me is I've been stressing community-based participatory research since I've been the director, but the importance of that and the power of that, I think what it is, it completely empowers the community to begin to take control of their own situations. So, I mean, I think it's just been fabulous, like in Savunga, where the members of the community are actually out there doing the sampling, understanding how you do this. I think those were some of the really important things for me. I guess another thing is, you know, Alaska is so vast and so huge, and the distances are so large. So the need, in many cases, for communities to be able to provide for themselves, that's not something that's going to go away quickly.
Thank you. I think this might be a good place to end, although, Dr. Birnbaum, I'd like to just invite you to make any other closing remarks about NIEHS or your trip to Alaska or anything that you'd like to say.
No, I think the main thing would be that we are really here to help improve the health of our population in Alaska, but wherever they may be. So thank you all for your attention, and I look forward to dialoguing with you again.
Thank you so much. I do have a couple of closing announcements, so if folks could just hang on the line for a couple minutes. We'll let you know when the podcast for today's call is available on our website. Our next call is just 2 weeks from today on Wednesday, October 15th. We'll be discussing toxic chemicals in schools and what you can do to protect children's health. And our guests will be Claire Barnett, Director of the Healthy Schools Network, and Dr. David Carpenter, Director of the Institute of Health and the Environment at the University at Albany. And please don't forget to support our Che Alaska calls with your tax-deductible contribution at www.akaction.org. And all contributions will be matched dollar for dollar by a special grant from Groundswell's Catalyst Fund. Again, I want to thank each of you for joining us today. Dr. Birnbaum, thank you so much for your time this morning. We really appreciate it, and we look forward to more discussions in the future. So have a wonderful day.
Cool. Thank you all. Bye-bye.
Thank you, everyone.